what you wanted us to be. We are what we are. That's the way it's going to be. If you don't know, you can't educate us or no equal opportunity.
That is the great Bob Marley with Babylon System. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Tuesday, November the 27th, and things have just gotten hotter for the Obama administration over the September 11th attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi and the president's intended nominee for Secretary of State. Well, we just had a news conference that gives us a little bit of insight as to how the battle is shaping up. Listen to this.
Interrupt you for 1 second, Congressman. I want to go to John McCain, who is just coming out of the meeting with Susan Rice. Let's listen in.
Discussion with Ambassador Rice and the Deputy Director of the CIA. We are significantly troubled by many of the answers that we got and some that we didn't get concerning evidence that was overwhelming leading up to the attack on our consulate, the tragic deaths of four brave Americans, and whether Ambassador Rice was prepared or informed sufficiently in order to give the American people a correct depiction of the events that took place. It is clear that the information that she gave the American people was incorrect when she said that it was a spontaneous demonstration triggered by a hateful video. It was not, and there was compelling evidence at the time that that was certainly not the case, including statements by Libyans as well as other Americans who are fully aware that people don't bring mortars and rocket-propelled grenades to spontaneous demonstrations.
Senator,
we're going to...
Bottom line, I'm more disturbed now than I was before that the 16 September explanation about how four Americans died in Benghazi, Libya by Ambassador Rice, I think does not do justice to the reality at the time, and in hindsight clearly was completely wrong. But here's the key. In real time, it was a statement disconnected from reality. If anybody had been looking at the threats coming out of Benghazi, Libya, it was jump out at you. This was a Al-Qaeda storm in the making. I'm very disappointed in our intelligence community. I think they failed in many ways. But with a little bit of inquiry and curiosity, I think it would be pretty clear that to explain this episode as related to a video that created a mob that turned into a riot was far afield. And at the end of the day, we're going to get to the bottom of this. We have to have a system we can trust. And if you don't know what happened, just say you don't know what happened. People can push you to give explanations, and you can say, I don't want to give bad information. Here's what I can tell you. The American people got bad information on 16 September. They got bad information from President Obama days after. And the question is, should they have been giving the information at all? If you can do nothing but give bad information, isn't it better to give no information at all? So my belief is, not only is the information bad, and I'm more convinced than ever that it was bad, it was unjustified to give the scenario as presented by Ambassador Rice and President Obama 3 weeks before an election.
Senator, can you support her as Secretary of State nominee?
I want to say that I'm more troubled today, knowing, having met with the acting director of the CIA and Ambassador Rice, because it's certainly clear from the beginning that we knew that those with ties to Al-Qaeda were involved in the attack on the embassy, and clearly the impression that was given, the information given to the American people, was wrong. In fact, Ambassador Rice said today, absolutely, it was wrong. I don't understand. The CIA said clearly that that information was wrong, and they knew by the 22nd that it was wrong, yet they have not cleared that up with the American people to date in coming forward and say that they were wrong, including the President of the United States, having parroted, also talked about the fact that this is a reaction to a video, the attacks in Benghazi. And what troubles me also is that, you know, obviously the changes made to the unclassified talking points were misleading. But just to be clear, when you have a position where you're ambassador to the United Nations, you go well beyond unclassified talking points in your daily preparation and responsibilities for that job. And that's troubling to me as well, why she wouldn't have asked. I'm the person that doesn't know anything about this. I'm going on every single show. But in addition, the fact that it's not just the talking points that were unclassified, but clearly as part of her responsibility as an ambassador to the United Nations, she reviewed much more than that.
Senator, do you support her as a Secretary of State nominee?
Before anybody could make an intelligence decision about promoting someone involved in Benghazi, we need to do a lot more. To this date, we don't have the FBI interviews of the survivors conducted 1 or 2 days after the attack. We don't have the basic information about what was said of the night of the attack that's been shared with Congress as of this date. So I remember the John Bolton episode pretty well. Our Democratic friends felt like that John Bolton, you didn't have the information needed to make an informed decision about Ambassador Bolton's qualification, John Bolton, to be ambassador. And Democrats dug in their heels saying, we're not going to vote. We're not going to consider this nomination until we get basic answers to our concerns. All I can tell you that the concerns I have are greater today than they were before, and we're not even close to getting the basic answers.
I have many more questions that need to be answered.
And so after a meeting with Susan Rice, who is presumed the front runner and expected to be...
All right. Well, we have a very good idea of what the fight is shaping up to be. We will get to that in greater detail in the second half of the program. I wanted to just give you an idea of how things are unfolding. Just a while ago, they just finished their discussion with Susan Rice, and the battle lines are now seriously drawn. So I wanted you to get an idea of where they're going so that we could get going in our second half of the program. But first, let's take a look at the impact of international laws on the conduct of both sides in the Israeli-Gaza conflict. Our guest is Mark Levine, professor of Middle Eastern history at University of California, Irvine, and distinguished visiting professor at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Lund University in Sweden. He's the author of the forthcoming book about the revolutions in the Arab world. It is titled, The Five-Year-Old Who Toppled a Pharaoh. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I'd like you to, from your perspective, give context to the Israeli-Gaza conflict from your particular point of view, your particular area of interest.
Well, there's several ways we need to contextualize the latest flare-up. The first is, you know, what was the immediate cause? Certainly each side claims the other side caused it. Israel says it's a response to ongoing rocket attacks, and if anyone searched the web, you can see the numbers. Each side has different numbers, but certainly hundreds of rockets every year fall into Israel. And clearly, you know, those are war crimes, especially if they were attempting to hit civilian targets. On the other hand, most or many of these rockets are in response to ongoing Israeli and much more deadly Israeli violence in Gaza. The almost weekly, if not daily, shootings, killings, bombings that Israel engages in Gaza. And, you know, Hamas itself was fairly good about maintaining the ceasefire in terms of its own people. There are other groups in Gaza that Hamas doesn't control, even more radical groups than Hamas that are associated with Al-Qaeda or would like to be. So it does not have full control of the Strip, and the more it cooperated with Israel, the more it lost control of more radical groups. So the first element is to try to understand, did this happen in a vacuum? No. Who is most to blame for the latest flare-up? And there we can all decide based on our own views, but certainly this goes back a long way, and each side has a share of the blame. So that's the first element, who caused the latest flare-up. The second one is, what's the larger political context? And the larger political context in Gaza, there's actually two contexts. One is in Gaza itself, which is that when Israel pulled out in 2005, it declared that its occupation of Gaza was over, and therefore it bore no more responsibility for the Gaza Strip, and almost immediately imposed an almost total siege on it because of Hamas's rule, especially when Hamas formally took over. And that created a set of conditions in Gaza which were clearly intolerable. I was there several times during the period, very unlivable, and helped lead to this cycle of violence continuing. The larger issue involves whether Israel could withdraw from Gaza and even say we no longer occupy it when, in fact, it's still occupying the heartland of Palestinian territories in the West Bank. And the weight of international legal opinion on that, including the International Court of Justice, the Security Council, even the Goldstone Report, clearly state that you can't do that, that the Palestinian territories remain legally occupied by Israel, and therefore it must behave in a certain way in order to be in accordance with international law, which it hasn't done. So from that perspective, what we have to think about is why. Why can we not get this larger conflict to come to a successful, peaceful close? And that's sadly the questions that no one is asking because we're so stuck on the immediate questions.
Well, suppose you take a stab at it. How do you bring this to a close? What has to happen for the conflict to be resolved?
Yeah, that's the question of the hour. I just have a new Al Jazeera column probably coming out in the next day or so on that question. There's really only three possible ways this turns out. You know, Israel has said its main goal is security, and no one can blame Israel for wanting security. The problem is that from the beginning of the occupation, the goal of the occupation was not security, it was settlement, which is why there's well over 500,000 settlers, which are illegal, all of whom are illegal under international law, and the incredible disruption and destruction of Palestinian life that all those settlements have caused. So if Israel wants security, the best way to do that would be to withdraw from almost all the settlements, because they're all illegal, and then maintain a military occupation until it can reach a final peace agreement. If it did that, there is no one, and I've spoken to Hamas people many times, there is no one who would continue violence against Israel if it actually was withdrawing from the vast majority of the settlements. That is the root cause. So if you want to end this from Israel's perspective, from the Israeli side, you have to start withdrawing from the settlements. If you're not going to do that, then you have only two choices. Either you say, which is what the Likud party has always said, there's never going to be two states in any meaningful sense, and then you have to figure out how you give citizenship to millions of Palestinians without destroying the Jewish character of the state. This is the conundrum that the Likud party has been dealing with, and many leaders like Moshe Arons and others for years have admitted that at some point down the line, you're not going to have a Jewish state, that you're going to have to give them all citizenship and be just a normal, democratic, non-religious state. But they push that well into the future. If you're not willing to do that, the only answer is apartheid. The only answer is continued occupation, and then you're going to have exactly what you have now, which is continued violence. So there's only three choices. From the Palestinian side, you only have two choices. One, you continue with a kind of semi-violent, semi-civil resistance, which isn't getting you anywhere because neither is strong enough on its own, right? And in the context of pushing for a two-state solution, which is clearly never going to come in any viable sense, or you have to relinquish a century-old dream of Palestinian independence in a territorial state and push for some kind of single democratic or binational or parallel, whatever you want to call it, state structure within all the territories of Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem as the best way of maintaining your rights. So for both people, in the end, for both peoples, it comes down to a simple question. What is the single most important thing? Is it having a territorial, ethnic, religious state, no matter what the cost, in which case both sides should keep doing what they're doing and get nowhere? Or is the most important thing to have the fullest possible rights that a human being is entitled to in the 21st century and the fullest possibility to realize your potential as a human being? If you want to do that, then, as is already happening in both societies, more and more people are thinking outside the bounds of a national or territorial state towards some kind of post-state solution where all, as my Palestinian and Israeli friends like to say, all the inhabitants of the land from the river to the sea have the same full human, civil, and political rights. So, you know, that's the most likely scenario in the long term, but it's going to take a long time to get there because, sadly, all sides in this equation who have power, Palestinian leaders, both Hamas and the PA, and the Israeli leadership, get too much out of this status quo. They get power, they get money, they get prestige, they get cars to drive around in, they get, you know, all the things that would be lost if they actually went in the other direction. And the people on each side are not strong enough or, you know, willing enough to take the risk of radically challenging the status quo.
Well, up against that proposal, or up against that scenario, are two deeply rooted and some would say permanent pieces that are at the root of the conflict in a real sense. One, on the Israeli side, Zionism, and on the Palestinian side, a long historical memory of ownership as a nation that, in fact, was systematically displaced through conspiracy of Western powers. So how do you get rid, how do you propose that people get rid of these things, which are at the root of identity in terms of, you know, I'm an Israeli And therefore, this state is mine, and the state is founded on Zionist principles.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the question, and that's why you don't do that as long as you remain within a 19th, actually, but certainly 20th century Zionist or Palestinian nationalist perspective. I mean, the problem is that the solution that 99% of the time has worked in the modern world, which is modern, territorially independent states that are more or less monoethnic. Obviously, the more multi-ethnic or multi-confessional they are, the more problems they tend to have. So the goal, you know, was for hundreds of years to create a state that was more or less dominated by one ethnic group and had sovereignty over a specific piece of territory. That doesn't work in every place. It didn't work in Switzerland, for example. They had a lot of blood before they figured out this kind of condominium arrangement that they have now. It hasn't worked in other states. Israel-Palestine is a case where that paradigm never could work. It never could have worked. And you know, no matter how hard you want it to work, not you, but anyone wants this to work, no matter how hard anyone wants to preserve the idea of a Jewish or Palestinian state on part of that land, it empirically really can no longer happen, because the only way it could happen is if Israel withdrew from the vast majority of settlements, and the architects of the settlement enterprise did everything possible to make sure that couldn't happen. And already by the 1980s, Israeli scholars were saying, if you think you're ever going to divide this land again, don't think that, because it's already too enmeshed. The settlements are too enmeshed into Israel. So that's already 1987 when the first scholar wrote that, and we're 25, 30 years on, and nothing has changed. So the first thing we have to do is admit that Oslo and the two-state solution was a chimera. It was a myth. It was stillborn. It could never happen. The next thing is, so what do we do about it? And that's where you have to get creative. I've been working with a team of Israeli and Palestinian and Swedish scholars and policymakers for the last 3 years on a project called the Parallel States Proposal for solving the conflict, which maintains a two-state structure politically, but delinks the long-held link between territory and nationality so that Palestinians and Jews could live anywhere in the territories, in whatever numbers they have demographically, without disturbing the basic demographic balance within each two political structures. And we think that this is, in fact, the only possible solution, because it allows Jews to live where they most want to live, which is the biblical heartland of Israel. It allows Palestinians to return in whatever numbers they want to and live in Jaffa or Haifa. But each side still has its own state structures. And that we, you know, that's one proposal. There's so many other proposals out there, but it takes political will, and it takes things getting bad enough, and we've seen this in Egypt and Tunisia. Revolutionary change happens when you feel you have nothing left to lose. And as bad as it is in Israel-Palestine, Israelis and Palestinians clearly, in terms of a larger social or mass psychology, don't feel that things are so unbearable that they're willing to go to radically change their most basic identity. And until they do, the status quo, the inertia of the status quo is so huge that it will not be stopped, and this will just continue on and on.
How realistic do you think your parallel states proposal will be in a part of the country that has, for so many years, been gripped with this the double helix of Palestine was Palestine. Everybody lived in Palestine. In any event, the parallel states solution that you're proposing is really a return to what Palestine used to be, which is everybody lived in Palestine. Jews, Christians, Muslims, no problem. Everybody lived in Palestine, even going back to biblical times, the Moabites, the Jebusites, all these different ethnic groups lived Palestine.
Right. Now, the difference is.
So, but if you go with a parallel state, the question is, how do you erase this feeling of still, as we approach something of equanimity in the 21st century, it has come at the great expense of one group more so than the other. And I mean, people who were living there, and they chose there, and they, by military might, and through the military support of others, were able to prevail and basically get to live the way Absolutely. They wanted to live on their own terms.
This is a great question, you know, but history, you know, I always tell my students, history doesn't care who's wrong or right. It only cares, you know, who's smart or strong, right? And, you know, so Palestinians clearly are on the losing side of this history. There's about 1,000 other peoples in history, if not 10,000, who also have been on the losing side of history, most of whom we've never even heard of, including most of the Native American tribes on whose land most of us live on and don't even know who they were. So, you know, there's a lot of historical examples of peoples who've lost their land. We could say it's immoral. We could also say it's just the way history progresses, and that's the way it goes. The one thing you can't do is erase. And the problem with Oslo was that it specifically tried to erase the past instead of acknowledging it. And when Yitzhak Rabin said, we don't want to live with the Palestinians, we want a divorce from them, you know, what he was doing was trying to erase a past, which was exactly what you said. Pre-1948, Palestinian Arabs and Jews lived together. It wasn't great. There was a lot of conflict, but they managed to live together. There's a wonderful documentary that just came out on Al Jazeera. You can find it online, of the citrus industry in Palestine in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and the incredible amount of collaboration and cooperation right up until the war. In 48. I mean, there is a past. So I'd say rather than trying to erase, and anyone who's ever been to a shrink knows, if you try to erase bad things, they come back to haunt you much worse than if you acknowledge them. So I think we need to acknowledge, or they need to acknowledge, the incredible pain that this conflict has produced. They need to acknowledge the reality of the history as best as scholars on both sides understand it. And there is really something close to a very strong consensus among contemporary scholars, whether they're Palestinians, Israelis, Jews, Europeans, whatever, on how this conflict emerged and proceeded in the last century. That's not really a debate anymore. But from there we need to say, well, we've acknowledged this. What is our goal? Do we want our children to live with the fullest possible human and political and civil and economic rights in a country that, you know, while it's been cursed politically, has been blessed in so many other ways, fertility, the beauty of the land, all the other ways that this country has been blessed over the centuries. If we do, then what is the arrangement we can do so that we both feel secure and that we all have as much opportunity as possible? And I think, you know, the only way that you can do that today is through some sort of either parallel or bi-national solution, that the single most important thing is allows Jews, because they have the power now, so why would they do it otherwise, allows Jews to feel secure in a situation where they are no longer the majority in the country, which has already happened, and no longer immediately control the overwhelming amount of force and feel like they have to repress the others in order to continue to feel secure. Unless you can do that, the Israeli Jews will never give up the power, no matter what the justice of the situation is, and no rational person would either. So if we can't figure out a way, the world, cannot figure out a way to create a situation where those who have the power now feel safe in a different political order than the one that has guaranteed more or less their security till now, they will never give up that power unless they are forced to. And the international configuration of forces right now and in the near future certainly doesn't seem like it's going to change to one where Israeli Jews will have to give up their power. So this is, you know, this is the situation. Maybe it's not fair, but it's the situation. How do we do it? Very slowly, and, you know, from the Palestinian perspective, I think the single most important thing would be for, you know, those who are still engaged in armed struggle to end it, because it's utterly counterproductive, even if you think they have a legal right to do it. And secondly, to also give up the myth of Oslo and demand a different order and be willing to engage in the large-scale, massive, long-term civil and civic resistance that we saw in Egypt and Tunisia until Israelis cannot continue the occupation. That's, to me, the only way this is going to change.
Well, how about another way? One way would be to compel both sides, and one side has really been more guilty of it than the other side. There are so many international conventions that are broken, so much of international law that is not observed. And again, when you, if you are going to implement a plan, one, how do you, you talked about erasing the past. This is very, very, I mean, the very notion of nationhood is identity with the land that you occupy. I mean, your borders. That's what
not, creates well, no, I'd have to correct you. Actually, for Jews, for 2,000 years, it wasn't, right? Until Zionism came, in fact, Jewish nationhood was specifically divorced from the land,
but,
except
but,
in
but
France.
But to be very clear, I mean, for Jews, it was also part of the religious... If you're going with a Zionist example, the Zionist rationale for it, by that notion, they were compelled not to have a nation.
Sure.
Because they had sinned. This is the biblical explanation. They were not entitled to a nation until they had come to God. If you're going with a Zionist interpretation. So the fact that they founded a nation is itself in contravention to biblical, you know, the biblical fiat.
It's in contravention to the traditional Jewish interpretation, certainly.
Right.
The national,
so,
I mean, there's so a religious
we have that discussion going, but
right.
What is it, why is it not important right now? Or why is it, I guess, it is going to be considered that international law, we just erase the past and forgive the fact that people have, this nation has just decided to just go there and just take the land because, you know, it was given to them in the Bible by God.
Yes.
All right. So why now? We do have international laws that said the very occupation of the land is illegal. We have laws that say that nations assisting in the illegal occupation of the land themselves are breaking international law. What has to happen to compel these nations to obey international law?
This is a wonderful question. The reason you called me is because I just co-authored a piece specifically on the international law dimension. The reality of international law, and it's also the reality of national law. You know, when you live in a corrupt state, let's say, you know, there might be laws against theft or killing, but if you have the power of the state behind you, you can do whatever you want, and the law doesn't matter. In an international system, it's even worse. So, you know, Israel, certainly, and we see this now because we just got word, you know, it's just these leaks that, you know, that the U.S. is saying that it will not oppose Palestine's bid to have a non-member state status at the UN as long as they do what? What's the single most important thing? As long as they stop any attempt to bring Israel before the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, which is one of the most important reasons why they want to have this state status, so that they legally can do that. So we know the level of war crimes that Israel has committed, and crimes against humanity, and even crimes against peace over the years. It's impossible to deny it, which is why Israel is so keen on this, willing to sacrifice allowing it to be declared a state in international law, as long as that state won't try to prosecute it for these crimes. But the reality is, you know, China, the U.S., Russia, every powerful state in the world commits war crimes as much as they want to with impunity, and so do its clients. There's, you know, that's the way the international system works. And in a way, you know, war crimes trials are for the losers, not for the winners in this struggle. What you're saying is, I think, the single most important question of our age, but it's inseparable from the larger question of how do you bring justice, social justice or environmental justice, to people everywhere. Because in the same legal architecture and political, you know, rationality and calculus that allows Israel to go on, committing politicide in Palestine, allows the Syrian government, which is sponsored by another P5 member in the Security Council, to go on massacring, exponentially more people. It allows China to continue occupying Tibet and using it as a nuclear waste dump and just committing politicide there even more successfully than Israel has in the occupied territories. And it allows Russia to, do what it did in Chechnya, and you could go on and on. And it also allows for the incredible economic exploitation, which is just as bad as the political exploitation of indigenous and poor peoples in the developing world, in the global south, all over the world. It's the same architecture. So this is why the global Occupy movement, for example, is so important. It's still in its infancy. It still has enormous problems before it can have a kind of power that could actually change policies in the developed world, enough to change this architecture. But it's the beginning. And so I think the only chance we're going to have is when you see all that international energy that's directed right now towards protesting Israeli rule in Gaza, not to stop doing that, but to become part of the larger global struggle against, the current architecture of the world system. If you don't do that, if you don't transform that, then nothing's going to change. And as the latest climate report from the UN pointed out, we're all pretty much screwed. So, you have to think of Palestine as a symptom of a much larger disease, which is the system that we live in, which is producing such devastation and degradation all over the world. Half the people in the world live on $2 a day or less. Billions of people live on $1 a day or less. Right? If you're going to have a world where half of the people in the world live on $2 a day or less, Palestine is the least of your problems. That's the sad reality. And until we can think about how to defeat that bigger thing, we're never going to be able to change people's attitudes or compel Israel to stop its own rather small, however painful it is for the people living there, small occupation, right? So that to me is unfortunately the larger issue.
Questions for our guest at 1-888-874-4888. Our guest is Mark Levine, Professor of Middle Eastern History at the University of California, Irvine, and Distinguished Visiting Professor at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Lund University in Sweden. We'll be right back with your calls right after this. Come on and take it for granted. Much too long. This is Late Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and our guest is Mark Levine, Professor of Middle Eastern History at the University of California, Irvine. And we're talking about a context, a kind of international take on the conflict in Gaza and Israel, between Gaza and Israel, I should say, the State of Israel. Your calls at 1-888-874-4888. So have you tested, I know you're developing this and you're working with scholars, so it's largely an academic endeavor right now, but have you tested the idea on Israelis and Palestinians and their receptivity to it?
And a strong support from many settler leaders, which is very interesting. And, for them, because their presence there, and we're not talking about the economic settlers, those hundreds of thousands who moved to the settlements because they were cheaper and they had incentives and they would leave if given the appropriate incentives. But the hardcore settlers, several hundred thousand of them, let's say, they certainly like this idea because it allows them to live in a Zionist state and allows them to remain where they are. Now, the problem is, what we have to understand, if you look at settlements, if you travel around the West Bank, and you look at just the built-up area of settlements, most of which are on hilltops above Palestinian villages, they're not that much territory. In fact, settlements tend to be built, the actual built-up areas are often built on land that may be privately owned and certainly illegally expropriated, but it's not land that was constantly in use, the literal built-up area, because Palestinians never tended to build up on the hills where it was windy and didn't have as much access to water. The problem is that these settlements come with them all the land they expropriated around it, all the olive groves, everything else for security perimeters and to use for their own agriculture. If there was a way for settlers to remain in place but relinquish most of the control over all the extraneous land outside the built-up area of the settlements, they could certainly stay without doing, you know, without disturbing the local geology or ecology of the process. And many of them are willing to do that. In fact, one of the main people who was involved in this process from the beginning, Yisrael Harel, who's a columnist for Haaretz, was also a settlement leader, one of the main leaders of the settlement movement, and he's brought it to other people, and also Palestinians. We've had talks with many Palestinians. Ironically, it's the more religiously grounded ones, especially even people within Hamas, who have thought this idea sounds interesting, and because they too want to be able to feel like they can live anywhere. So for people who are most concerned with a sort of 19th, 20th century notion of political sovereignty, this idea makes no sense. For those who are most concerned with staying attached to the land they're on or want to return to the land where they're from, this is quite appealing, because they would rather have that in a new kind of architecture than have the old architecture and have the status quo. So it really depends on what your overall, you know, your overall political orientation or goal is. But we have certainly gotten some success, and in fact there was just a conference in Jericho right at the start of the Gaza war that one of my colleagues was at, where people, you know, brought it up, not from us. It's just floating around and people are starting to talk about it because it's been publicized. And the Israeli writer Eyal Megid, I don't know if any of your listeners read Hebrew, but he just had a column in Haaretz where he talked about this plan a lot. And he's actually, while he's a leftist, he's also very long-term friends with Netanyahu. So, yes, this plan has been brought to a lot of different people, and in principle, a lot of people like it. But, of course, doing it is quite a different matter, because you're literally recreating an entirely new architecture of political, economic, and territorial power in this territory.
Well, it's a concept in the making, and it's worth exploring. And I want to ask you about two particular factors. One, reparations. And two, demilitarization.
Well, I mean, you know, reparations, you know, black people are still waiting for 40 acres and a mule, right, in this country. So reparations, I mean, I think reparations are something Palestinians deserve. I also think Jews who were expelled from Arab lands also, you know, deserve reparations. I don't think those two things are immediately tied together, as Israel tries to do. In fact, in many cases, especially in Morocco, Israel was actually pulling Jews out of Morocco who didn't want to leave based on an agreement with the Moroccan government, not on their own volition. You know, but I mean, do reparations mean, you know, giving a check or cash to every individual person, or do they mean a large fund that goes into the development of this country, the way German war reparations went into, you know, were paid to the Israeli government? I think the single most important thing is an acknowledgement by Israel of the reality of what Zionism has meant for Palestinians. I think, you know, the reparations means, to me, the most important thing is to allow Palestinians to develop an autonomous economy that is not at the mercy of a much larger and more powerful Israeli state. That's much more important than just giving some money to some people one time or several times, however it was structured. It's building a viable economy in the future that is integrated with but not controlled by Israel. In terms of a demilitarization, again, you know, everyone talks about a demilitarized Palestinian state if there was a two-state solution, which is, you know, certainly the way it would be. But, you know, Israel is one of the most militarized countries on earth. So, and there's a huge psychological cost to that, as anyone who looks at Israeli society and sees how it not only treats Palestinians but treats its own people. The psychological, emotional, and political costs of this militarization have been huge over time. So, you know, what would be part of this structure, the kind of structure we've been talking about, is creating a structure where Palestinians and Jews feel secure enough so that they no longer have to be so heavily militarized, whether it's as a resistance movement or as an army. You know, that has to be at the core of it, because that's the only way you can heal, maybe not this generation, but the emerging generation, of the wounds of this century-long conflict. So it has to happen, but it has to happen in the context of a region that's still heavily militarized, and a situation where no one is suddenly going to say, okay, well, we're all friends now, let's put away our guns and pretend everything's good, because that's clearly not going to be the case. So that has to be a goal, but it has to be done, you know, extremely wisely and in a way that encourages people to feel safer rather than encourages them to feel more paranoid.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for presenting and sharing with us the concept that you're working on.
I hope to talk again soon.
Yes, I hope so. I really would like that very much. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We've come to the end of our program. We didn't get to the big brouhaha in forming in Washington, D.C., but certainly we'll get to that tomorrow. But your homework assignment is to pay attention to that tonight in the news. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Jack Wildman, Rasmus, coming up next. What I would like you to do, if you wish to just send me a note or two, lead stories, LEID stories, at gmail.com. Thank you so much. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.